The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 20th of May, 2020. I'm in Cummins in the West Coast, and I'm sitting here with Michael Dowdle.
Yes.
Michael, could you please state your full name, date of birth, and your service number?
My full name is Michael Morris Dowdle. My birth date is the 13th of April 1949, and my service number is 472153. That's one number you never forget.
Thank you very much for coming and speaking with me today, Michael. Could I just ask you please to just to talk a little bit about your childhood years, family?
Yes, I was born in Port Lincoln. I lived at a little town called Coulter for 10 years. That was my grandmother's place. Then we moved up to our family farm at a place called Mount Drummond in 1961. And there I continued my schooling. I'm the youngest of four children. I basically spent the next 5 years. I left school when I was 15. I went back on the farm for a while. Then I went and worked for different farmers around the district, learning to shear and learning to drive tractors and all that sort of farm machinery and all that. And then in 1969, I had to register for national service. I didn't think much of it. Then in June, I received the word that I'd been called up to serve 2 years in national service. I went into Pakapunyal in October 1969, where I'd done recruit training for 10 weeks. We came home for Christmas leave, then back in January, we went back to Singleton for core training. Another 10 weeks there. Then after that, we were sent up to Townsville in the 4th Battalion. They weren't full strength by a long way. We went into one platoon, which was the 4th Platoon in B Company. It was the only platoon in the company. And I spent the next 12 months there in Townsville, and we built the numbers up over that period of time. And then end of April 1971, after I'd done all the training and ready to go, I went over to Vietnam with the advance party to relieve the 2nd Battalion.
How did you feel? Do you remember how you felt at this stage? You're roughly about 22 years old.
I was 20 when I went in. I turned 22 a few days before I went to Vietnam. But it was pretty exciting because I'd only have probably a maximum of 6 months to go after I got into Vietnam, because I knew I wasn't going to do a full term. But I thought I was very fortunate to even go, because I'd trained with these guys. We'd been training together with that group for probably 4 to 5 months. And we're a pretty close-knit group, and I would have been very disappointed if I never got a trip to go over there. While we were waiting for the rest of the battalion to get there on the Sydney, that took 2 to 3 weeks, I think, for them to get there, we'd sort of done a bit of work with the 2nd Battalion guys, and they showed us a few ropes and how to avoid, they weren't going to try and find any fighting at that stage, because they were ready to come home. You see, they were having a very low key, but they were very good. But they did give us hell there for a while because they didn't. One of their sayings was that no one's got 365 days in a wakey to go. That meant like a full tour and a sleep. A wakey is called a sleepover. They were giving us that group a bit of a workout for that very reason. But we were looking forward to it, and of course it was different from training to getting into the real stuff.
Whereabouts were you based?
We were based at Nui Dat. That was our base, but we spent most of our time out in the bush. When the battalion got there, we were on our own then. We had to, battalion commander was Jim Hughes. We used to call him JC because that was his initials, so he was bulletproof. But he had us working pretty tough in the first couple of operations. And I can always remember that. I thought this is going to be sheer hell because we was out there for at least a month at a time. And it was full tack, it was no rest, you know, it was just, you had the mind on the job all the time. You know, looking, you know, searching and destroying, that was the aim of the operation, of course. But the conditions were probably the toughest thing I've ever done. The going was always tough, we was always hungry, because you had to carry 4 to 5 days rations on your back, plus all your ammunition, bedding, but we survived that okay, but we did lose a lot of weight. And sleeping on the ground, of course, it was just sleeping on not a spreadsheet, just a sheet of something just to keep the moisture off you. And dig a little hip hole to make sure you had a bit of comfort when you rolled up on your side. But conditions were terrible, especially with the infantry guys. That's how we lived, and I suppose that's why we were trained so well. We were put up with that okay. Yeah, but that was bush life.
Could you explain in a little bit more detail a day in the life of bunking down in the jungle? What was around you? What did you see? What did you hear? What did you smell?
Yeah, well, anybody that's been in a jungle, it's got that real musky smell. It's a dampness smell. There was a lot of bamboo that we had to cut through. That was our scouts' job, basically. They had to cut through that so the rest of the platoon could get through, you know, fairly reasonable. But it was very thick vegetation, a lot of vines and stuff. It was very slow going. You couldn't move real quick through that type of stuff. Whereas, you know, in a rubber plantation, it was different. It was more open and movement was a bit more, you know, quicker through that sort of stuff. And then you got out in the open country where it was more high grassy type stuff, the odd trees and paddy fields and things like that. So they were always underwater, of course. But we didn't work a lot in the paddy fields. We skirted around them. We tried to avoid the working class, I suppose. But in a lot of the rubber plantations, they were milking the rubber a lot of the times. That was quite interesting. They had the little bowls on the trees, and they'd milk, they used to call it, they'd come out of the tree and they'd go into the bowls, and most of the women would come around and collect the milk rubber and put it into vats, and they'd go off on their bullock or whatever they had pulling a cart. But that's something you had to be aware of, who was who. That was a great difficult thing, because there was a lot of people we come across, you know, who were they? It's just the clothing that sort of gave the enemy away, I guess. But yeah, I suppose, yeah, the conditions were terrible. There's always mosquitoes, there was leeches, there's, you know, scorpions, and there's little tree snakes and things like that.
Did you suffer bites from any of these?
Oh, yeah, that was shocking, yeah. Especially, they used to have another thing was called a head tick. Yeah, the tick. Well, I've heard of ticks in Australia, but these guys were quite a bit bigger. And that was something they used to burrow into your hair, and they're very hard to detect. So at times we had to get your hoochie, mate. We always have, you know, always have two guys to one tent, and they were called hoochies. So every so often you had to get your mate to check your hair just to make sure you haven't got any in your hair. And like I said, they had to be turned anti-clockwise to get them out. Otherwise, if you left the head in there, they would get infected, and then you have to get the medico into and sort that out. But leeches were bad. They used to get in the bottom of your GP, like the top of your GPs, into your socks. They'd bite through your socks and get into your meaty part of the bottom of your leg. And if you left them there too long, they make a reasonable hole in your leg. So if, even though all that sort of stuff, we had they call it an insect repellent stuff that used to pour over you anywhere that bugs would get into you, around the tops of your boots and around the sleeves, your shirts. But that stuff stunk more than after you'd been there for 5 days with, you know, BO. But that did help, and you had to have a mozzie net at night when you camp, otherwise you get eaten alive. You get used to it, but we never saw anything like that in Australia when we was training. That's something that really, I remember that very well. But life in the bush was, it was tough. There was always two men manned the gun, even when we were harboured up for the night. So we had gun pickets. Like a gun picket, you'd be on for probably 2 hours at a time. So you never got a lot of sleep, or disrupted sleep, basically, because there was always something happening. And there was always noise. There was always noise in the scrub. It was either artillery thumping away, you know, it could have been a few k's away, or mortars. So it was never peaceful. It was always something, noise, or, you know, choppers and things going on. There's always plenty of noise. But we had to keep extremely quiet when we were moving through the jungle or the field. So just try and don't make any noise so that you didn't give your position away, I suppose. That was it all about. And catch the enemy unaware. It all had its moments, I suppose, yeah. But yeah, the smells in the jungle, that like I said, it was a very musky smell, but it was something the guys up the front had the secateurs cutting their way through, making it a little bit easier, but for the guys that coming behind. So we worked in platoons most of the time. Our section was, we had three regular soldiers in it, and we had, I reckon we had six national servicemen. And I think we would probably have been the youngest section in the battalion, because we worked there one day, the average age was about 20 years and 8 months. We had two young fellas who were only 19. And a lot there in their mid-20s, so you only had to put a couple of 22-year-olds, and it sort of, there you had the boost of the number a little bit of the age was two of us. A lot of the times we never had a full crew. We were supposed to have 10 to a section, but a lot of times we had 7 or 8, so it put a bit more pressure on, you know, when you were doing your pickets and sentries and stuff like that. So there's always somebody on guard. Getting tired, it was very tiring. Even though we were young and fit, it wasn't much trouble. You know, we used to have a lot of breaks, and we'd have our backpacks on. You know, pretty weighty. I'm not sure how much weight it would be, but it was considerable weight. You just lay back on your pack, you know, in the afternoon, and you could doze off quite easily. But they wouldn't let you, of course. You had to be on full alert. My job in the section was, I was 2IC of the section. I was a Lance Corporal. I worked with the gun group, the machine gunner, and he's number 2. So we worked in that that area. So if we had a contact, we would, three of us would work together. A lot of the time I would be carrying ammunition for the gunner as well, so I was pretty well loaded up. And my job also was to always dish out the roster for the pickets and the gun that night. And I wasn't the most popular guy in that section because a lot of people want to have as much rest as they can, you know, like without being interrupted. So the gunner always got the first gun picket, so he got a good night's sleep because he had to carry the gun all day. It was quite a heavy piece of equipment. But we tried to spread it around so that everyone got a different shift every night, but I think the main problem is you just getting into a reasonable sleep and you get woken up to go on the gun picket. That was the thing. So, yeah, it was all interesting, but, we had our moments, of course. And
so what would you do to kind of keep spirits up?
Well, the first thing we had to do was, after a contact, it was make sure everyone was still okay, you know. That was the first thing you had to do, get around there while they're still in their positions to make sure everyone's okay and just talk to them, say, are you okay? That's about the only thing you can say. You know, you can't say, well, no, I'm homesick, I want to go home. You can't do that. You just got to say, well, we're here, we're a group, we've trained together, we know what to expect of each other. And I think they were all pretty good in that sense. They didn't take much encouragement, but you could see they get a bit slack occasionally. You know, you could tell that the rifle had dropped or wasn't in the right position, you know, wasn't up in the ready position. You just send a message down to, you know, get Blogsy up there to get with it a bit. Yeah, they know what to do. So we weren't an advisory person, I suppose. You just had to, well, you couldn't really talk. Mine was hand signals. And the only time you could sort of whisper a bit was when we was in the harbour position at night, where you could go around and give them their rosters and just make sure they're okay. That'd tell you if they're battling a bit, but if anybody had a little problem, they would get the platoon commander down and he would have a chat to them, so he was more trained in that area than I would have been. So, but he rarely had to do anything. They were all pretty good. Everyone's looking forward to get back to have 3 days R&R, you know, after you've been out in the bush, and that would go. We'd go down to Vung Tau for a couple of nights and just have a few beers and stuff and let your hair down, just relax. Then you'd go back to the base camp at Nui Dat and get ready for the next operation. So it was, you know, every time you go out in the scrub, it would be at least 30 days. So.
And did that ever feel normal?
I don't know how you describe it. It's very hard. It seems to be hard mentally as well as physical. To be just stay on the ball, you know. You don't know what around the corner or up ahead, or you know, it's not like we're in a front line or anything. It's a lot of our contacts come from down the back of the section, you know. We hardly had a hit up the front with the Souths, the bunkers. That was shocking.
The bunkers.
The bunkers, yeah.
You talk a little bit about the bunkers?
I can remember our first, we had a contact with Charlie, that's what we used to call him, Viet Cong. Next minute we were sitting on top of a bunker. You could see that it had been used, so something we'd learned in training to get an extended line, get one section go through, while the section behind us would cover us if anything happened. And that's the way that we went through our first bunker. And I thought, God, it was exciting. You know, it was exciting when we went through because we had grenades, we were flicking them in the holes if we could find one. It was quite exciting, you know. It was a bit chaosy, but, you know, I was yelling and screaming and carrying on, trying to get everyone to get through. We'd done that exercise that many times. It was quite good. This was late in the afternoon, and we went up a bit further from the bunker, and I harboured up. The whole platoon harboured up. We were fine for a while, and we reckon was movement out there all night. You know, there was movement there, but we couldn't do much because we didn't know whether the Claymore mines that they put out in front of the gun were turned around, and we thought any noise that had been out there, they could have been out there turning their claymores around. And so if they let the clackers go, they would come back on the guys who were on the gun. We didn't. We just stayed there and didn't do much that night. But it was probably one of the scariest things I've ever been through. You know, a lot of people go to war and say they've never been scared. But that was one thing that I was really scared that night. When the guy was going away to get my relief for me to go back to my hoochie, you know, he seemed to take a long time to go and get a relief. And I just sat there, I froze, you know. And that was one of those, like I said, that was the most scared I've ever been in my life since I was a kid. But that was okay. Next day, we had the tanks in there. They come in and they destroyed the bunker system. But I don't think you can destroy the bunkers because they're just an underground tunnels and works and things. They're all connected, so I think that's why, you know, the Yanks were bombing the hell out of the place, and they were just going down deeper. And well, they were deep, some of those tunnels. And
really? What sort of depth would they be?
Well, they'd probably... I did go back to Vietnam in 2012, went through the tunnel system out of Saigon, and they were probably 3 to 4 levels down. So they must have taken a real long time to put them together. They wouldn't have done that in a few years. That would have taken them a long, long time, and there was quite a few Ks of them. Yeah, they were like ants, really.
How would they disguise the earth that was taken out?
Yeah, they put it in the Saigon River. Apparently they put it in little bags, and that's why I think they were more like ants than human beings. They worked together, and they would just take a little bag out at a time. But that's why I said it must have taken them a real long time to dig these tunnels, and that's what they said, that a lot of it went in the Saigon River.
You mentioned the Claymore mines before. Was it quite common for them to be turned around?
Yes, apparently. We're very fortunate in our platoon. We had 3 or 4 guys that had already been to Vietnam in the previous tour. So we were very fortunate to have those guys, and they were telling us things that we never learnt in Australia. You know, just be a little bit aware of, you know, they could turn them around, they could be a booby trap out there. They were very good at digging up, like, mines and, you know, even the little... jumping jack mine, they call them, you step on and they come up and they blow part of your legs off, I suppose. That's what they were designed to. And a lot of them, they were, a lot of those explosives, they would have got out of Australian mines, and they've made them up themselves. They're very clever and dedicated, but bush life, I found it very tough. That's why I often say to Fox, I said, he said, well, we were in infantry, at least we were there. That was how it's saying, because if anything less, they had a reasonable time over there. Like, the infantry boys done it tough.
How many months were you actually in Vietnam?
Well, I went over in May. I got there on the 1st of May, and I come back on the 12th of September, I think. I had to come home to get discharged in October, yeah, that's right. So about 4.5 months.
Could you talk a bit about your last days in Vietnam and how you were feeling and what you were doing?
Actually, it was quite funny. They said, oh, you're going home. That's what the sergeant said. You've got to go home on this certain day. But he said, we want you to stay. I said, what do you mean? He said, I want you to sign on. And finished the tour, and there was three or four of us there, and we all said, well, if we sign on, can we get discharged as soon as we come back to Australia? They said, oh, no, no, you've got to be signed on for 12 months. And I said, no, thanks, I'm going home. But they were silly because, you know, if we'd kept that group going, I think we wouldn't have had the casualties down a bit later. After we come home, their last contact was on September the 21st, the Battle of Niue Lai, and they didn't lose anyone killed, but they lost 30 guys out of the company that one night, wounded. And Delta Company lost three or four guys killed. I thought that, you know, they had a lot of Rios come in after we left. Whether that had something to it, just upset the goings of the company. Whether that's true or they just had a bit of bad luck. But no, I think the last few days I knew we were going home, so we were trying to stay safe, I suppose you could just call it. They wouldn't let us go to on R&R on that last time we come home. So they made us stay back in Niue Dat for I don't know what reason. I suppose they had to keep us clean and we were on malaria and medication and stuff like that. So we, while they went to Vung Tau, the rest of the company, there was a few of us had to stay back in Niue Dat and we just done picket and gun duties and went to the bar, I suppose, yeah. And that was good, so.
How did you feel then, when the day came that, okay, today's the day, I'm heading home, how did you feel?
Oh, I felt good, yeah, felt good, but I felt sad that we're leaving my mates behind too, because we'd built a pretty good mateship over those few months. I was ready to come home. I can recall we was at Tonsonut airstrip. We had to wait and wait and wait. And anyhow, the plane was there. It was a Qantas 707 jet. So we piled on that, and it was good. And set off. They gave us a meal, we had a can of beer. Then I know when they flew over, I don't know where it was, out from Darwin somewhere, and the pilot called up and said, Australia's below us. And there was a hell of a cheer in the plane to say that we're back nearly home. When we got to Sydney, they put us through customs. And they said, you've got a rail ticket to Adelaide. And we said, no, we're not going on a train. I said, well, if you want to go on a plane, you have to stay overnight and catch a plane in the morning, but at your cost. So everyone just went back to the motel and we got a few beers and up early in the morning, caught the plane to Adelaide. And that was our welcome home. Which pretty, you know, that was pretty, you know, you'd been away for a while and you come home, like, you know, like yesterday or the day before, 2 days ago, was in Vietnam. And 2 days later, I was back on the farm. And I thought, this is weird. That was probably one of the strangest things, like. And then I went to a game of footy, must have been a few days later, they were playing finals. And someone said, oh, where you been? I haven't seen you for a while. They didn't even know I was doing 2 years in the National Service and been to Vietnam. That just shows you how strange the whole thing is, you know, that two people didn't realise where you were.
How did that make you feel? People didn't realise what was going on?
I felt disappointed. But back in those days, Chris, there was a bit of a problem with Vietnam vets. A lot of our local school teachers, they didn't really like it. They classified Vietnam vets as like the guys who went to Gallipoli. You got your bums kicked. I said, no, we never lost a battle while we're there. Australia never lost a battle. But they didn't realise. They just thought, they shouldn't have been there. Australians shouldn't have been there. And that sort of stuck a bit for a few years after that. A lot of the, especially the school teachers, the locals were good. They were excellent. In fact, there's two or three of us from where I come from, the local footy club, they had an evening one night and they welcomed us, two or three guys, home. Because over that three-year period, there was four guys out of the same footy team that served in Vietnam. And that's not bad for a little tin pot town like Kapiti. It's just out the road a bit. And I'm not sure if anybody would have that record in the local footy team. That's just a stat, I suppose, isn't it? But we did have 13 guys up there that surfed from around the Cummins district, which is not a bad effort for that period. Yeah, I was disappointed at the way some of the locals treated us, but the RSL was fantastic.
How has the RSL post-Vietnam, how has that helped you over the years?
Whether it's helped or not, it's just that I guess that it's somewhere to go and talk to people. Like I said, when we come home, I joined the RSL, and there was probably three or four other Vietnam vets here. And most of the Second World War blokes, they're in their 50s years of age. Then there was a handful of the First World War blokes, would have been sort of knocking them around the 80 mark. But I don't know how the 80-year-olds sort of accepted us. They didn't say much. But the Second World War blokes, they really done a fantastic job, and they took us on board. But I just felt like I shouldn't have been here with those guys, because they were my heroes, the Second World War blokes. And I thought, it wasn't for them, Australia mightn't have been what it is today, what they'd done. So I just didn't feel a part of it. So I didn't go to RSL for many years. I used to go to the annual dinners and come along, and this place here would be packed with mainly that vintage of people, of those Second World War guys, and they'd have a hell of a time, They'd be having a few grogs, they'd have the piano in the corner, they'd be singing songs and carrying them. But they used to sing songs at a meeting, and that was the camaraderie, I suppose, that they built up all the years. They built this hall, and they really enjoyed themselves, where there was only a handful of us guys, and we'd sit in a little corner and talk about what we'd done, and they'd be having a really good time with what they were doing. But that was just the way they were. But I remember one night at a dinner, he's a good friend of ours. He said, "I'd like you to come have a chat with me." I said, "Oh." He said, "I want you to talk about Vietnam." I said, "Will you tell me what you were about in Second World War?" He said, no. He said, "Let's go and have a beer." So he didn't want to talk about it, but he just wanted me to say something about my experience of it. And that's why I sort of left it there, I said. And probably wasn't until a few years later, we had three or four of these Second World War guys, they were probably 80. They opened up a few times about their experiences, and I thought that was fantastic. And, he said he'd been overseas for 5 years, nearly 5 years. He spent 5 years of his service overseas. And he said, I said, how did you ever adjust to civvy life? He said, you never adjust to civvy life. And I think, and he brought something home that night, and I thought, when I come home, everything would be still the same, like nothing's changed. But something had changed, and I thought for years and years and years, and what it was, I'd changed. It hadn't been the town or anything outside, I'd changed. I'd come home a different person. Even my wife told me that. She said, your mother told me I was never the same after my 2 years away. So I don't know what it was. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see what they were referring to, but I had changed. I even had to, the doctor who said I was fit and able and willing, fit as a mallee bully, said, when I passed my medical to do my national service. And I went and saw him probably 12 months after I come home. I said, Doc, I said, I think I'm going mad. I said, do you think I'm mad? He said, no. He said, I'll send you this guy in Adelaide. You see what he comes up with? And I said, who is he? He said, oh, he's a shrink. And I said, well, what's this all about? He said, oh, he said he might be able to help you. Anyhow, I was in Adelaide and went to this guy. He said, oh, yeah, he says a lot of veterans have problems. He said, I'll put you on some medication. He said, that'll fix you. And he put me on Valium. And it didn't do any good, because I didn't mind a drink back in those days. I had a like to drink beer, and it didn't work, so I just threw it away. So I just battled on for years and years, and my wife, when after we got married, she said, I think we'd go to a hypnotherapist. She said, they're good. They might be able to help you. And he was okay, but nothing really made me feel better. I'd always had this, I don't know, anger in me for some reason. It was in the back of my mind all the time. And anyhow, we found this, a new method. It was called the Silver Method. It's a meditation type thing. So I went and done the course, and I think that's helped me somewhat. It's just how to relax. Don't get uptight. But I think it's all, it's a part of the service. That's, a lot of people have that problem. They call it post-traumatic stress, but I think it's adjustment to back to civvy life again. And another great thing that happened to me was the Welcome Home in Sydney in 1987. I hadn't seen those guys for 16 years, and we had a hell of a roll-up at that, and it was just amazing to see those guys that aged a little bit, that you knew who they were, to just embrace them and talk about things and see what they've been doing and have a couple of beers, and you know, everyone was enjoying themselves. And it was, and that's what I say, when we're together in those, you know, before we even went to Vietnam, like that 4 or 5 months plus with time over there, we were so close-knit. We were always looking out for each other. And I think that's a part of the good thing that come out of the 2 years national service. And we still have our reunions. We've been having reunions since that day, since back in 1987. Every couple of years we get together, we go around Australia and meet somewhere every 2 years now.
When's the next reunion planned?
It's going to be in Melbourne. Canberra, I think, next year, 21. It's the 50th anniversary of our time in Vietnam. So after this pandemic gets get rid of that, it might be a bit more clear. Yeah, so something to look forward to again. But the last one was in Adelaide. That was last year. Yeah, that was fantastic. Didn't have far to go. But no, we've been to Perth, we've been to Townsville, we've been to Tweed Heads, we've been to Tassie, No, that's great. But everyone's 70 now, so we've got to make the most of it, because there's a few getting not as good as they used to be. There's some characters amongst them. And that's probably a good thing too. You know, a lot of people had, sense of humour. And a lot of that sort of kept everyone going too. You know, if someone said something funny, it spurts them up a bit. I found that the people that had a sense of humour survived a lot better than the ones that didn't. Well, I retired when I was 60. I promised my wife I was going to be not farm when I was 60, so I promised her that. And at 58, I was looking forward to 60. I was had enough. I just had enough. I just wanted to do something else. So we leased our property out, and I go up there and do a bit. It's only half an hour's drive from where I live, so. No, it turned out pretty good.
So any closing comments you'd like to add before we finish up?
Well, I'd like to say, the RSL is probably not like it used to be. We just haven't got the veterans that we had. That's just a part of life. I think, they were good times we had back in the, from the 80s, I suppose, right up to 2000, that 20-year period. I did join legacy. I've been a legatee for 30 years, so I look after the girls. My girls, they suffer just as much as the guys, so they don't mention too much about the widows in real life anymore. It's mainly about the veterans, so that's something I really enjoy is legacy work.
Michael Dowdle, thank you very much for talking with me today and sharing some stories, and it's been absolute privilege. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.